everyone. It's Monday, and you're with us on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Fewer than 200 people attended the Justice for J6 rally in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. There were more police and journalists than angry protesters on hand for the gathering. It had been advertised as a show of support for the rioters who attacked and breached the Capitol on January 6. Sparse attendance this weekend should not be understood as a triumphant defeat of the troubling ideologies which fueled insurrectionist violence in January. Stopping further acts of violence by political extremists is critically important, but it's only a starting point for responding to January 6. It's equally important for us to understand and interrupt the ideologies that fueled those actions. University of Chicago professors Bob Pate and Kevin Ruby studied the Capitol rioters and found that they were distinct from the general profile of the far right. The overwhelming majority had no ties to established right-wing groups, and these rioters were far more representative of the general population. In a discussion of their study results published in The Atlantic, Pape and Ruby write, quote, "Unlike the stereotypical extremists, many of the alleged participants in the Capitol riot have a lot to lose. They work as CEOs, shop owners, doctors, lawyers, IT specialists, and accountants." In short, it's possible the violence of January 6 was not the result of American extremism. It was an outgrowth of American mainstreamism. In July, U.S. Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn testified before Congress, and he recounted his terrifying encounter with rioters who understood their actions as wholly American, even responsive to the directive of the American president.
More and more insurrectionists were pouring into the area by the speaker's lobby near the rotunda, and some wearing MAGA hats and shirts that said Trump 2020. I told them to just leave the Capitol, and in response they yelled, "No, man, this is our house. President Trump invited us here. We're here to stop the steal."
So if American identity is at the center of the Capitol insurrectionist rage, it's about this fundamental struggle over whose house this is and who has a right to hold power. American identity is sometimes unspoken at the center of many of our current debates. Voting rights, a struggle over who deserves to wield power. Critical race theory, a struggle over who deserves to shape the story of American history. Immigration policy, a struggle over who will write the story of America's future. Here to help us understand the content and context of these struggles is Mei Nye, professor of history and Asian American studies at Columbia University and author of The Chinese Question. Professor Nye, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So, Professor Nye, you've written, "If we don't understand the history of exclusion, we cannot understand racist hatred." What are some of the connections between policies of exclusion and white supremacy?
Melissa, the United States is unique among most nations because people who are immigrants actually have a path to citizenship. That is, if they are legal immigrants. And so it's fairly easy to become a citizen if you're an immigrant. So if you really want to keep people out of the citizenry, you have to keep them from coming from the country. And that's where immigration restriction and exclusion are intimately tied to the question of citizenship.
Is this also, when you talk about the relative ease of citizenship, is this also about the 14th Amendment birthright citizenship? Is this something that we see in other nations around the world?
Absolutely. Some other countries that have birthright citizenship also restrict it to descendants of citizens or even ethnic restrictions. So the United States does provide citizenship fairly easily to anyone born here and anyone who can naturalize after 5 years of residence and a clean record.
Okay, so what's valuable about U.S. citizenship? Why desire it? Why is it valuable for those who come in and seek it?
Citizenship in the United States gives you basically two things. First is the right not to be kicked out, right not to be banished or deported. And the second is the right to vote. And hence you see a lot of the furor around citizenship, around voting rights right now, because it has the right to vote that's at stake.
When you hear "Make America Great Again," and then even after the end of the Trump presidency, the desire to hold on to a presidency that for some group was making America great again, What else do you hear in the sort of undercurrent of that?
What I hear is make America white again, or make America controlled by white people again. And I think this is really problematic, because citizenship has always been contested. It's always been a question about, notwithstanding the legal rights to citizenship that are afforded to broad swaths of people, it's also been the subject of controversy about who should even have that access. So immigrants from Europe had a very easy path to citizenship in the 19th century, but people of color have been kept out of that circle. Obviously, we know about Dred Scott, which denied Black people the right to be citizens, including free Blacks. And after the Civil War, with the 14th Amendment and the creation of national citizenship for all, including African Americans, I mean, we know, right, the 14th Amendment essentially repeals Dred Scott. But then you have the problem of other peoples, right, of Chinese in particular, who were not even coming in large numbers, but the idea that Chinese could become a community in the West Coast to begin with, and then later in the country, was abhorrent to mainstream white Americans. And hence you have the exclusion laws keeping Chinese from immigrating and keeping all Chinese from naturalized citizenship.
I remember you and I were colleagues at the University of Chicago, and it was grappling with your work that for the first time as a Southerner, I'd heard all the stories of basically Atlantic immigration and forced in migration through the triangle trade of enslavement. And then, of course, sort of the European stories about the in-migration that was voluntary. And then, of course, our country has been obsessed for years now with the kind of migration across the southern border. But I was less aware of the ways that we had policed the Pacific migration and in-migration. Can you say a few words about that and what we can learn about sort of the American story from the Pacific theater of immigration?
The Pacific story is actually very connected to the South and the Atlantic, because what drove Americans, white Americans, especially across the continent in the early 19th century, was the struggle to extend slavery, right? Western expansion is driven by the sectional conflict over slavery, right? Each side wants more states so they can have more control in the Congress. So Western expansion is driven by sectional politics over slavery. And it's also driven by an ideology, which we call manifest destiny, which is the idea that the entire continent belongs to white people, that it's God's gift to white people. So it doesn't matter if you roll over Native Americans along the way, dispossess thousands and hundreds of thousands of indigenous peoples from their land. It's this whole idea that the continent belongs to whites. And once they get to the Pacific coast, they can look behind them to see what they've conquered, but they also look towards the Pacific and they see all new possibilities of more conquest, but they also see the possibility of people from Asia coming to North America. And so this combination of racism and expectation leads to a racially driven movement to keep out people from the Pacific while still encouraging people from the Eastern United States to go west. And people who went west were not just Northern white Americans, they also came from the South. During the Gold Rush, white Southerners went to California, and a lot of them brought their slaves with them to help them mine for gold.
Can you also just reflect for a moment on the Dawes Act of 1924? I mean, there's a moment when citizenship is actually imposed, right, on indigenous communities.
Right. Well, the Dawes Act, starting in the late 19th century, created a different kind of policy towards Native Americans, which was to forcibly assimilate them, right, by saying that, oh, we'll give you your land that you can own in fee simple. You can own your land as individuals, and then maybe you'll learn to be like a white person by being a farmer. And this was really a trick to have Native Americans sell their lands to white people, right? So there's this process of forced assimilation or stripping of their sovereign rights as Native nations or tribes. And then in 1924, there's the American Indian Citizenship Act, which imposes citizenship on all Native American peoples. And in my view, that is not an act of inclusion. that is an act of final exclusion in the sense that Native peoples are stripped entirely or almost entirely of their sovereign rights. So this is where the treaties really go down the drain.
You know, many times in our kind of contemporary discourse, I feel like we presume that exclusionary immigration policies are partisan. And particularly during the administration of President Trump, there was a lot of media coverage of some of the horrors that we saw at the southern border. But it's worth noting that both President Trump's predecessor and his successor, President Obama, and now President Biden, have been fairly exclusionary in their immigration policies and practices. How do we get past a sort of partisan narrative about it to really think about how American it is to try to close our borders, exclude and push folks out?
I think Biden's proposal for immigration that's now in the Congress, it's not moving anywhere right now, obviously, because they have other things that they're prioritizing. That's actually a good reform, I think. It really does open up immigration. It reunites families. It increases the number of green cards that will be available for people. But Biden is still saddled with the problem of America's geopolitical imperial legacies in parts of the world, which are driving refugees to leave their countries, violence in Central America. And so he has to grapple with that problem. And it's a problem he didn't make, but it's a longstanding problem of American politics. And, you know, actually, when it comes to foreign policy, Biden is not as progressive as he is on many domestic policies. So immigration is both a domestic question insofar as it concerns communities that live among us and who are us also and have rights in this country, but it's also very much a foreign policy question. And this is where I think the Biden people fall down in many ways.
Mei Dai is professor of history and Asian American studies at Columbia University and author of The Chinese Question. Thank you for your time and for your insights.
It was great talking with you, Melissa. Take care.
Thanks. Now, we asked for your reflections about American citizenship and identity. We asked you to take one sentence and tell us what the word citizenship means to you.
Citizenship equals being a good neighbor. Jane Hilson Aiello, Centennial, Colorado.
Hi, this is Keith from Dallas, and being a U.S. citizen, having citizenship is one of the most important things to me. I appreciate it almost every day. My father fought in World War II. I taught in public schools. I pledged allegiance to the flag. I fly my flag proudly. Even though we're in a terrible time right now, I'm glad to be an American citizen.
It means being part of something bigger than myself. Dwight from Bardstown, Kentucky.
I am a native-born American citizen, and for me, being an American citizen is about having the freedom to vote, the freedom to pursue whatever makes me happy, and the freedom to say whatever I would like to say.
Hi, my name is Kim from Bellevue, Nebraska. What does citizenship mean to me? It is absolutely a joy. I served in the military for 6 years, but it's more than that. I find it wonderful and joyous and challenging to be an American. I appreciate the freedoms and the responsibilities I have as a citizen. I'm also in the only country on earth that calls itself in its founding documents an experiment. That's where the challenge comes in. Our nation was built with a good deal of racism and classism and misogyny and colonialism. And our challenge to move forward is how can we be a great country and, move away from those bad things. We can do it. We can do it.
Hi, this is Bailey from Moorhead, Minnesota. To me, America is about responsibility. We have so many choices left up to ourselves to make. And to me, that means that we need to take responsibility to make choices that benefit more than just ourselves and our families.
Hi, my name is Patrick. I'm calling from Los Angeles, California. I am luckier than lucky to have been born in the United States. the freedoms that are available to me demand that I give back to this country and pay my fair share for all the opportunities that I've been given.
Hello, this is Connie from Blairsville, Pennsylvania. American citizenship means not only do I have freedoms, I have a responsibility to ensure I am willing to stand for those Americans whose freedoms are challenged by prejudice and racism in order to ensure all Americans are guaranteed the inalienable right stated in the first line of the Constitution.
We love it when you talk with us. So remember, you can send us a voice recording to takeawaycallers@gmail.com.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.